If you look out at a garden, I think it's easy to think that there's nothing going on if we can't see it. But actually, every handful of dirt is a microcosm of activity and life. And you know what? The same is true of our bodies as well. And there are more organisms living on us than there are cells making up our bodies. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. My guest today is Rob Dunn. He is a biologist and writer in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University. He's an outstanding writer, believe me. His writing has appeared in Natural History, BBC Wildlife Magazine, Scientific American, Smithsonian Magazine, National Geographic, and many others. His first book was Every Living Thing. It was awarded the National Outdoor Book Award for Natural History writing. And his latest book, The Wild Life of Our Bodies, takes a look at the long human relationship with other species, be they tapeworms or tigers or hookworms, and how changes in those relationships are affecting our health and well-being. And I'm certainly hoping that you'll join in today with your questions and comments as we move along. Are you kind of fascinated by what lives on and in your body, or would you rather not think about it? Or maybe you have questions about a part of the body and what might be lurking there. You can ask Rob Dunn if you dare. Hey, Rob, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Hey, Larry, a real pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you are a great writer. I tell you, I'm in addition to doing this program, I'm a professor in the Department of Life Science Communication, and I want to use your book as an example for those budding science writers that we have in our department. It's really well done.
Oh, that's very generous, Larry. Thank you. I appreciate that.
Your work really focuses on the creatures that have lived on and in human bodies for millennia. And a lot of people don't like to think about that.
So I actually started off working in tropical forests, and I've kind of drifted toward humans. And one of the things that's led me in that drift is the realization that, I mean, most of what we encounter every day we know nothing about. And for me, the stories of what we don't know are fascinating. And so, I mean, it's true that if you walk through your house, each thing you touch is covered in hundreds of species, and most of those we know nothing about. And so on the one hand, I'm just totally fascinated with that reality. On the other hand, as a human, in a way, it horrifies me that every day each thing we touch is covered with life, each person we touch is covered with life, and we mostly don't know about those species. Collectively, that keeps me pretty darn busy.
I would think so. Actually, Stephen Boscobel has a question I think is worth bringing up at this point. Steve, hi.
Hi. If people from the U.S. or Canada or other more developed countries visit Latin America particularly, and I'm sure other less developed countries, we have to be careful about the water we drink and some of the foods we eat, and otherwise we'll get sick. But people who are permanent residents of those countries don't seem to have a problem. I'm wondering if the bacteria in their gut or something about their body has developed to tolerate bacteria that we can't.
Huh.
Yeah, that's a great question.
Yeah.
And it's a fascinating question on many levels, one of which is that nobody really studied that question for decades. I mean, even though everybody sort of recognizes Montezuma's revenge and that you have to be careful with the water, and we know something about individual pathogens. And so if you get, obviously, if anybody gets cholera, whoever it is going to face problems. But then there is this other reality that water in particular countries seems to not affect the people in those countries, but it does affect Americans or Europeans. And until very recently, nobody had a clue what was going on there. And in the last couple of years, it's gotten cheaper to study the species living in people's guts. And one of the things that we're starting to see is that in different regions of the world, people have very different microbes living in their guts. And so there are now good data from Bangladesh, for example, that suggests that all of the species that we thought were the normal species in the gut and the most abundant species seem to be missing in many Bangladeshis, and they have a whole different group of species. And so it seems logical to posit that something about those species is allowing the Bangladeshis to deal with their water in a different way than I would deal with it. But we don't really know yet. All we know that there are these differences and that something's going on that differs between, you know, you and me and a Bangladeshi who drink the same water, which is just fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah, it definitely is. Steve, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call very much. And, well, while we're at it, why don't we get Chad in from Green Bay. Chad, hi.
Good morning. My question is, thankfully I don't have family that live around here, so I can ask this and use my real name. But I had an aunt that had head lice over 10 years, and I don't know if she has it now, but it was mainly through the 80s. And so then, therefore, she watched us kids, so I got head lice. With her, how I heard at the beginning of the show that it may be unhealthy to get rid of these creatures on your body. Head lice is my question. How unhealthy is it to get rid of head lice? Not saying that it's healthy to have head lice, but with the chemicals and everything like that, that's my question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating question. So head and body lice are actually very, very, very closely related. And so body lice, we know, transmit a number of dangerous pathogens. Head lice don't seem to, although nobody understands why. And so head lice, to the extent that they can become body lice over generations, and as body lice transmit pathogens, actually can be conceivably dangerous. That said, a lot of the chemicals being used to treat them aren't great either. But if your aunt would have shaved her head, it would have been that tends to be a pretty simple, if socially inappropriate, response. But there's just a trade-off there in terms of the use of chemicals to control something like head lice and the potential dangers of having it. But in general, it's something that's better to control.
Yeah. There we go. Thank you very much, Ted, for calling. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions and comments. As we talk with our guest today, Rob Dunn, about he's doing so much fascinating research. We're going to take a look at your belly button, too, pretty quick here. He's got a kind of a rainforest comment here. He's got a rainforest of species that are living in people's belly buttons. He is the author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, among other things. It's great to have him with us. What's going on? Let's take a look at the skin. What's going on at the surface of our bodies?
So on the skin, you have a layer of life, the sort of patina of living creatures. And on no individual person has been exhaustively sampled, but probably on the average person's skin, thousands of species. And those are that is actually your first line of defense against bad species. And so let's viruses and bacteria both. And so let's imagine a norovirus lands on your skin and is, hoping to make its way to your mouth. The first thing it encounters is not your immune system, but this forest of cells. And so it's a pretty amazing forest. And we know that which depending on which species you have in that forest, your immune ability will differ. There have been studies where babies have actually been colonized on their skin by bacteria that we know are good, and it's helped to prevent those children as they grow up from getting bad pathogens. And so it's the friendliest layer of life you can ever encounter.
Mm. You talk about in your book and elsewhere about antibiotics and using antibiotics to treat various conditions and other just drugs in general. The problem tends to be that we don't always. Well, we can get rid of some of the pathogens or some of the problem causers. We also get rid of others that could be beneficial.
Yeah, and that's true both on the skin and in the gut. And it's actually similar to what's happening if you're using those antimicrobial wipes. And then in all those cases, those are sort of biocides that are pretty general in their killing. And so most of the people listening owe their own lives or the lives of somebody in their family to the use of antibiotics. And so antibiotics have saved us. But now that we know that they can save us, we have to use them judiciously and also keep in mind all those good bacteria that we also kill when we use them.
Yeah.
And so Clostridium difficile is a leading cause of death in older hospital patients. And it's essentially a pretty innocuous bacteria that when people take antibiotics a lot and clean out their good bacteria, it just grows really quickly. It's like a weed in an old field. And so the incidence of Clostridium difficile is a direct consequence of the overuse of antibiotics.
Mm.
And if you want a lesson on why not to overuse antibiotics when you don't really need them, the best treatment for Clostridium difficile infection is now a fecal transplant. And so you're getting somebody else's poop up your nose to recolonize your gut. And if that's not a incentive enough, I don't know what would be.
Oh, man. Susan, or Sarah in Madison, thanks for joining us. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I know a number of years ago, a lot of people had ulcers, and it was later shown that there was a bacterium that was responsible for it, and I think that they're treatable now. I'm just wondering if your guest knows of any studies that are being done that show similar connections between bodily ailments and certain bacteria that we didn't realize were in our or on our bodies, or we're starting to see that they're not as innocent as we thought they were. I'll just listen off the air.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, so in general, when you think about your body, you should think about your own cells and then the cells of thousands of other species, most of which we don't understand. And so my assumption when I start to study these species is that, some of them are doing things we haven't figured out yet now in almost every sample we take. And one of the really interesting examples in line with the Helicobacter pylori, which is what the questioner mentioned, is Toxoplasma gondii, which is not a bacteria. It's a protist. But it's a protist that for years was studied by basic biologists because it was known that It can only have sex in a cat, and it's first ingested by mice and rats, and so somehow it had to get from mice and rats into cats, and it was shown that it actually makes its way into the brains of mice and rats and makes them less risk-averse. It makes them attracted to the smell of cat pee, and it actually makes them more likely to be eaten by a cat and sort of fulfill the parasite's wishes. But nobody thought about that in the context of humans, even though it was known that this parasite could affect pregnant mothers by endangering the fetus. But then in the last couple of years, people have started to study humans with exposure to Toxoplasma gondii. And it's now been shown that people that have been exposed to Toxoplasma gondii, they have altered personality profiles. And so if you do one of those standard personality tests, you'll show up differently on the test if you've been infected. They're 2.5 times more likely to be in a car to cause a car accident. And infection by this parasite has now been shown to be the single best predictor of the onset of schizophrenia. And so here's this really important example that comes out of basic biology that nobody was thinking about 10 years ago. And it has this really fundamental effect. And the most amazing thing to me is that 80% of the French are infected with this parasite. And so it could actually explain the behavior of an entire nation.
Wow. Wow. Unbelievable. Having a really fascinating conversation today with Rob Dunn, biologist, professor in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University and author of, among other things, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, Predators, Parasites, and Partners That Shape Who We Are Today. I'm Larry Mueller. Glad to have you joining us today. Carl Christensen, our on-air producer on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we talk about the wildlife in and on our bodies today with our guest, Rob Dunn from the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University. Fascinating conversation, fascinating topic for me. And I want to give you a chance to join in. If you have a question, you can email us at talk@wpr.org, or you can post a question on my Facebook page. Just go to The Larry Mueller Show. Or you can phone us, and the number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Every line is busy right now with somebody waiting. So we'll go to Chris in Kewaunee and find out what's on Chris's mind. Thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Hey, this morning I'd like to talk about fleas. I have terriers, and they're good homestead dogs. That means they catch and dispatch anything that's not supposed to be living in the homestead. So that's any wide variety of critters, you know, from the minuscule up through, well, good Lord, just about anything they can catch. And I'm kind of curious why certain critters seem to be more prone to having fleas, why those fleas sometimes will jump ship and attempt to take up residence on my dog, and then why do I not get fleas if my dogs get them? Or on second thought, do I, or am I just much less a poorer host than my flea or my dog? Mm-hmm. So can you explain that to me?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. So there are lots of things going on there. One is that different fleas have evolved to feed on and live off of different hosts. And so there are many hundreds of species of fleas. And in part, what's going on there is that the blood of different hosts is different. The immune systems of different hosts are different. And so they've figured out ways to get around the immune system and to take advantage of the blood. And so there are human fleas. Unfortunately, they're not very common most of the places we live now. And so most of what might bite you in a house is a dog or a cat flea. But there are also mouse fleas and a whole suite of other species that can be found on the things that your cat is bringing in. And so, you know, their ability to colonize your cat or your dog is in part a function of their ability to get around the immune system of your cat or your dog and actually get their mouth parts into the blood. And so in every occasion in which a flea hops or doesn't hop onto your cat or dog or you, there's kind of a long evolutionary story playing out. And what we know for a lot of, we call these ectoparasites, parasites that live on the outside, where ecto is outside. And one of the things we know about ectoparasites is that they're better at hopping from one host to another host if they're more closely related. And so if you were hanging out around a bunch of monkeys, the odds that those monkey fleas would be able to jump on you and do really well, I mean, saying nothing about your leg hair or anything, is higher. The odds that a mouse flea does well on you were much less closely related is lower. And so there's a great evolutionary story playing out each time something does or doesn't hop through your house.
Got it. So it's really based on the difference in the types of species of fleas.
Yeah, exactly. That's the short answer. I could have just said that.
Sorry.
No, your version was better. I like your version, Rob. Thanks, Chris. Jim Thanks, Chris. In Montello. Hi.
Good morning, Larry and Rob. Pleased to speak with you again today. I talked with you yesterday, Larry.
Oh.
I have a question regarding banking your personal microbiome. I think I've got a pretty good personal microbiome because I grew up in the day when my grandpa gave me a pocket knife and says, now you use that to scrape the mud off the carrot you pull out of the ground. And I can remember him saying you have to eat a pound of, you know, a bushel of dirt before you die anyway, so don't worry about the little bugs. Come to find out, even though he was born in 1899, he was right for the most part, it seems now. But my question was, how long do you think it'll be before medical science starts finding a good way of banking our personal microbiome, if we think we have a pretty good one, or a physician does, so that it can be used as a probiotic for us specifically after we've undergone some medical procedure, which could range from, you know, antibiotics to get rid of something specific, or something as simple as recovery after the preparation for a colonoscopy, that sort of thing.
Hmm.
Yeah, these are wonderful questions. What fun. So for this one, there are multiple kinds of answers. So one is that the truth is, if we took a sample of your microbiome, we don't know what to feed most of those species. And so right now, we couldn't bank it. We couldn't bank all of the species. And I think we'll move more and more in that direction. But the truth is that, you know, each of us has thousands of species in our guts, most of which nobody knows what to feed. And so doing the whole microbiome is going to be hard for a while. But the second part of that is the acknowledgement that people differ in the quality of their microbiome, to be a little bit too normative. And so I think another thing that's going to happen soon is we're going to start to see legal issues popping up around who owns a good microbiome. And so right now, if you get a fecal transplant, it tends to be from somebody you know and love who seems healthy. But if we figure out, you know, that some gut microbes are help you lose weight, which it looks like that that's true, who owns those and how do we share them and how do we bank them? And so I think for any lawyers in the audience or young people who might become lawyers, there's some important things to be hashed out there. The third part, though, is the probiotic piece, and I think that that's the closest. There's a lot of work now on individual species that are beneficial and how we might inoculate people with those. And I think that that's we're already really pretty darn close in that regard. The major challenge, one of the major challenges there is that if you totally clear out your microbes, and so if you have a Clostridium difficile infection and they just blast you with antibiotics and then give you a fecal transplant, you get to start from scratch. It's like, you know, you till your garden, you get rid of everything that's in there, and you just plant the seeds. And that seems to work readily. But if you're starting with all your microbes that you already have and you're trying to add one to that mix, it's way harder. You know, it's like planting cabbage in a forest. And so there's a lot going on here, but it's moving very, very quickly. And I think that in general that scientists are a pretty conservative bunch in terms of speculating about the future, but folks working on microbes in humans right now are incredibly enthusiastic and hopeful in the way that, you know, technology was in the 60s or something. So great question. A lot of exciting things going on there.
Yeah, thanks, Jim. Doug and Randolph, your turn. Hi, Doug.
Hi, yes. A friend of mine had E. coli food poisoning, seemed to take all the stuff right out of the out of her. And then how long does that take to actually get the good bacteria back then again after that bad episode with E. coli food poisoning?
We don't know a lot about that. And almost certainly the answer is going to depend on which microbes she has in the first place, or he has. One thing we are starting to see is that Bill Parker at Duke Medical Center put forward the hypothesis a couple of years ago now that one of the roles of the appendix is to help restore good bacteria if you lose them. And it does now look like that's the case, that's actually the function of the appendix. And so if you have a really bad infection and you have your appendix, it appears much easier to restore your good microbes than if you don't.
Oh. You've got that's a fascinating chapter in your book about the appendix, by the way.
Oh, thank you.
I really enjoyed that. Doug, thank you. Roger in Lake Zurich, Illinois, it's your turn. Hello.
Yeah, hi. Can I ask two quick questions?
Sure.
All right. First one, we are near a forest reserve. We have a lot of wild animals in our yard and in our neighborhood. We have this neighbor that let this big blonde-haired dog run around without a leash. After approaching these people a couple of times, they wouldn't keep the dog leashed up, so I had to call the police. And they went and had a talk with them, and the dog's being kept locked up. But I think they're going to let it out again. But what dangers with parasites are we in for here with the wild animals and then this dog being let loose? You know, who knows what the dog picked up from these wild animals? The other question is, when you go to a lot of doctors, especially GIs, they want to do a colonoscopy or things like that, and they give you PEG, polyethylene glycol, to clean out your intestines for the procedure. I've had a couple of these tests, not a colonoscopy, but other tests, where they had to use PEG to clean out my intestines, so the area was clean for x-rays or whatever. So what kind of danger am I in now that my good bacteria has been wiped out a couple times by these doctors? And those are my two questions. Thank you.
All right.
Yeah, fascinating. So the PEG question, I'll have to just admit to ignorance on that one. I don't know enough about PEG to know what it does. And so I promise to read up, and maybe I can answer on Facebook later.
Mm-hmm.
With regard to the dog, there's a lot going on there. So we have a big study of 1,000 or 1,500 homes in the U.S. in which we're looking at which species people have in their homes as a function of how they live, what they live with. And one of the things we've been able to show really conclusively is that people who have dogs have very different microbes in their houses. And especially in urban areas, that looks mostly beneficial. The kids who grew up with dogs in their houses tend to be at less risk of allergy and some autoimmune diseases. But then there's also the other side, which the questioner gets at, which is that dogs are also, they're a conduit for good microbes, but they can also be a conduit for all sorts of pathogens. And so there is the possibility always with any of the connections we make with nature, both for connecting with good species and bad species. And so we will face a lot of these trade-offs in thinking about medicine and wildlife moving forward, and there are muddy answers rather than clean ones. Certainly dogs interacting with raccoons. Raccoons have a fascinating variety of parasites, many of which dogs can pick up. So there are possibilities there.
Just a little aside to that, I recall a study that was done on similar homes on energy use, and some homes did significantly better than others, even though they were insulated the same ways and so forth. And it turns out the ones that were worse had dogs.
Oh, that's fascinating.
Because they let the dog had to go in and out. They assumed that the dogs were, you know, the fact you're opening and shutting the door more often for the dog resulted in higher energy use. So
Roland Kays at the Museum of Natural Sciences in North Carolina has a study on chicken coops and backyards. And one of the things he was able to show in that study is that one of the biggest determinants of which species show up in your backyard, if you have a chicken coop or just in general, is whether or not you have a dog. That fewer things show up when you have one. and so that maybe more directly gets at the question.
Yep, it does. Marvin in Bayside, hi, thank you for calling.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, I have a friend who, in 1935, when he was a year old, contracted amoebic dysentery in upstate New York from unboiled water. He was eventually cured through a long process with doctors at the time, but he found that there was a residual effect in his system of the amoeba, he feels, in that he was, if he ate anything where the food was in any way spoiled and immediately reacted and he was able to excrete it. The same thing with perhaps unwashed silverware in a restaurant. He actually had a much better system and thinks that it gave him a long-term beneficial effect. Do you have any comment on that?
No, I mean, other than that it's fascinating. Our understanding of how all of the species in our bodies and our immune systems interact and how that affects us through time is incredibly nascent. And so I think one of the things that researchers are starting to realize is that anecdotes like that are ones that we need to pay a lot of attention to, that I think that we mistakenly thought 10 or 15 years ago that we kind of understood how these things were working, and the last 5 years have shown us to be far more ignorant than we imagined. And so I think the story like that is actually really important. But there's not a super simple answer, but there are lots of interesting things that could be going on. I mean, one of the things we've just started to realize is that there are actually taste receptors that line the GI tract that we didn't realize were there. And so they actually are sending subconscious signals to our brain about what they're tasting. And that could be influenced by the immune response to the amoeba. And I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things that could be going on there. Yeah, it's a great question. Terrible answer, but fascinating.
Thank you, Marvin. Steve in South Milwaukee, hi to you.
You know, I'm puzzled about something regarding bed bugs. I mean, we sent a couple of convertibles to Mars. We've had people walking on the bottom of the ocean. Why haven't we been able to develop a simple poison that they might, take? That's something in the compound of the blood and carbon dioxide or something, which they'd be attracted to that and carry back to their nest or whatnot and kill them without having to, take care of a whole house and go through all that routine. by the way, I'd like to find out if you've changed your lifestyle with the research that you've done.
Yeah.
Oh, these are great questions. There are lots of smart people working now on bed bugs, but the truth is that DDT worked for them, and they evolved resistance to DDT eventually, and then we stopped using DDT for good reasons. But one of the effects of the dramatic global reductions in populations of bed bugs with DDT and a couple of subsequent pesticides was that people mostly stopped studying them. Mm-hmm. And so before this resurgence of bed bugs, there really were very few labs in the world actively working on them. And so, for example, we don't know much about their evolutionary history. We didn't know until recently how they spread. And so I think part of the answer is that we weren't really focusing on it because we don't seem to do a very good job of focusing on things that aren't acute problems at that moment for lots and lots of people. And so now there's a lot more research on bed bugs, and I do think there are a lot of exciting things going on with potential solutions. But I think mostly the answer is we didn't try. And I mean, that's one of the fascinating things for me about homes in general, that we have a study with Michelle Troutwain at the Museum of Natural Sciences where we've gone into 50 homes to try to find all of the animal species living in those homes. And when we talked to pest control people or entomologists, everybody thought we'd find 10 species in the average home. And we're finding hundreds. And most of those are species we know nothing about. And so there's a little yellow wasp we find in almost every house that lays its eggs in the body of some animal in the house. And we don't know what. We don't know what the species of wasp is because it's never been studied. And so I think that's, I mean, it's an amazing reality. You know, if something kills us, or if it really annoys affluent people, we study it. But in the time between, we don't. But the second question is how I've changed my life. That's fascinating. I think about it all the time because I have a survey of information about all these species. And so I guess I've changed it in a lot of ways. I mean, I try more actively to eat around the edge of the supermarket, you know, so eating whole foods that'll give more for my gut bacteria to work on. I try to be more active about getting my kids, you know, outside, out in the dirt. We don't totally understand the benefits of microbial biodiversity, but we know they're there, and it certainly doesn't hurt to get them outside for lots of other reasons. You know, I think about getting a dog, but I'm traveling too much to really do it. I never use antimicrobial wipes if I can avoid it. I'm judicious with antibiotics. Unless something can really, really be dangerous, I don't use them. I think about that question a lot.
Yeah, and it sounds like you've made a fair number of changes. Yeah.
Yeah, or try to anyway.
At least try to. excuse me, John, in Kellnersville, next with a question. John, hi.
Hello. Fascinating program. See, I've long been interested in knowing more about a little critter called Demodex folliculorum.
Oh, goody.
It lives in our follicles of our eyelashes. Is it? It appears to be harmless, and how common is it?
We have a paper. So we're working on a Demodex a lot. So these are mites. There are two named species. They're animals living on your head. They're actually all over your body, but people seem to think it's more polite to describe them as being on the head, I think. And it now looks as though all adults have them. Every single adult we've been able to sample has them. And so here's an animal living on your head, on your, you know, privates all around. They come out at night to have sex on your, you know, wherever. They don't have an anus, and so they just fill up and eventually explode because they're overfull with excrement. And we know very, very little about them. We're finding new species of them on people without looking very hard. They appear to be implicated in rosacea, but it's not simply that they cause it, because everybody has them, and so it's something about maybe which mite you're getting. It's not very clear what's going on there. But to me, I mean, they're this amazing emblem of our ignorance that, you know, how dopey could we be that there's an animal living on all adults and we really don't know very much about it?
Rob Dunn, our guest today, we are talking with him about, in part about his book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, all the wild and crazy things that actually live on and in us. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. As we visit today with Rob Dunn, biologist and writer in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University, great to have him along to talk with him about, the wildlife of our bodies. That's the title of his book, by the way. And certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Lines are pretty much all full. But keep trying, and we'll get you on. Yesterday, I mentioned, Rob, that I was going to be talking with you, and I mentioned the belly button business and your research on what lives in our belly button. And it's you call it a rainforest of life.
Yeah, it totally is. So we find in the average person at least 60 species of bacteria. Among the most common of those are bacteria no one's ever studied. And then we also see totally outrageous things. So, for example, the science writer Carl Zimmer had a bacteria in his belly button that's only ever been seen from the Marianas Trench at the bottom of the ocean. There are all sorts of interesting things happening there. And one of the things that's really interesting about the belly button is that it has glands called apocrine glands that are also found in your armpits and down below the the belt line. And the only function of those glands is to feed bacteria. And so one of the things we're really interested in is whether this is actually an adaptation of the body to favor particular lineages of bacteria that are good as defenders against pathogens. One of the examples of these glands we most often think of is the armpit odor, which is actually the smell that's produced when your body provides a bunch of food to these bacteria. And the differences in smell between person to person are a function of those bacteria, but also of the glands. And so it's really this amazing system we understand very little about. But we've been engaging the public to sample their own belly buttons to help us see really what's going on. And it's been mostly just fascinating. We also get lots of emails with pictures of people's infected husbands, and we could do without those. But otherwise, it's been great.
And you also have Armpit Palooza. You're doing a similar with the armpit, are you not?
We are. We really want to understand what happens when you use deodorants and antiperspirants. Is what's happening good or bad? How does that relate to what happens in other primates? That's been really very interesting. And one of the things that we show is that it looks as though people who are using antiperspirants and some deodorants are actually the way those are working is that they're killing the bacteria that our body is feeding, and in their place favoring a bunch of other kinds of bacteria that we know very little about. And so, for example, we actually find some bacteria in the armpits of people who use antiperspirants that are metallotolerant, and so they're adapted to deal with the weird metals that you find in antiperspirants. And so it's one of these fascinating cases where every day we're applying a treatment to this layer of skin, of life on our skin, and we really don't understand what it's doing. And so that's what we're trying to do in that work.
Boy. Well, I'm going to ponder that a little bit while we go to Tom in Janesville. Tom, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'd like to ask Rob about foods. A little while ago, I heard a program on public radio about gut flora, and they had done some study and found that people who ate a lot of meat, particularly red meat, had a predominance of gut bacteria, which produced some harmful substances, particularly the cardio system. and that you could change that, or those people who ate a lot of high-fiber foods, and particularly fermented foods like kefir and yogurt and sauerkraut and pickles and so on, had a predominance of very beneficial bacteria and possibly even none of the, I don't know, call them meat bacteria, which were harmful. Can you talk about foods, particularly fermented foods?
Yeah, that's a great question, and actually a very good summary of that work. So it is the case that it appears that eating a lot of red meat in particular does seem to favor some lineages of bacteria that produce these compounds that get into the bloodstream and cause some problems. The other thing we know, and so there's a, I mean, there are a range of compounds being produced, but some of them are lipopolysaccharides, which just a fancy word for a simple thing. But we also know that there are good microbes that line the gut wall that can be lost, and they can be lost via a variety of means. And when those are lost, one of them is Ankers mania, that the gut wall actually becomes a weaker. And so in reality, they're sort of part of the gut wall. And so when the gut wall becomes weaker, the other thing that happens is any bad compounds that are in the gut make their way into the body more easily. And so those include the things being produced by those meat bacteria. They also include a range of other things. And so I think there are a lot of good reasons to eat, fibery food that make your bacteria work. And then there's, I think, growing evidence of the influence of fermented foods on gut microbes. I don't think we quite understand what's going on there yet. But it certainly doesn't seem to harm the microbes that we need, and it seems as though maybe it's offering some benefits. As a measure of how mysterious this all still is, most of the literature on guts treats people's guts as though they're all the same. But in the 1940s and 50s, there were studies just comparing the length of the intestines of people from different places. And those studies found that the intestines of people in different regions differed by meters. interestingly, the people with the longer intestines tended to be from places where they were eating more fermented foods. And so it seems possible that there may be these really pervasive effects, not just on the gut microbes, but on the development of the gut as a function of fermented foods. But we don't really understand all the pieces of it. And I think one of the things for listeners to be wary of is that when scientists make some new discovery that's a piece of this bigger story, it often gets reported as though it's the answer or it's the whole story. And the truth is we have a pretty meager light we're shining on a pretty complicated and dark world. To treat each new study with the realization that it's part of a big picture.
Bigger picture, yes. Thanks, Tom. Joe in Prairie du Chien, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. You pretty much touched on it. I was going to ask if we have basically shooting ourselves in the foot by trying to stay clean. But my also question would be, do we have this ability, the microbes, are they in the womb, or are we basically exposed to them once we're born? And does exposure to a very divergent environment help us?
Yeah, another great question. A few years ago, nobody could answer that question, but it's now looking like one of the places we get a lot of these microbes is from breast milk for breastfed babies. And so there's actually a kind of bacteria that in adult women is very rare that appears to be moved through the body and into the breast milk. And with each gulp of breast milk, babies get a huge dose of that bifidobacterium bacteria that helps them to digest the milk. And so some microbes are coming that way. Vaginal birth is really a messy process, and so babies are getting a lot of fecal microbes through birth itself. And the more we look, the more we see that the body is actually doing pretty predictable things to help babies get new microbes. And so we don't know much about how the skin microbes, for example, establish, but the idea that there's something interesting and controlled by the mother happening there doesn't seem far-fetched. The one obvious implication in getting to the caller's question is that babies who don't breastfeed, babies who are born C-section, are likely getting very different microbes, and we actually see a signature on that on newborns in terms of which microbes they have as a function of how they were born. And so all of those things that we do that prevent us getting those microbes we need have the potential to be detrimental. And if you don't get them initially, it seems as though there's a fair amount of chance in whether or not you're acquiring them. And so kids who grow up with the dogs in their houses tend to have some health benefits. And I actually think one of the things that's happening is if those kids fail to get microbes that they need, that when the dog licks their face, they're actually getting some dog fecal microbes that play similar roles. And it's been shown that the kids with in houses with dogs actually have some dog microbes in their guts. Does that answer the caller's question? I feel like maybe I missed something there.
I think you got it. Yeah, Joe?
Yeah. And also, I mean, once you're born, is your environment a factor? I mean, if you live in the jungle where you've got multiple species all around you, or you live in an urban environment, are you accepting, and how early does this occur?
Yeah, great. Another great question. So their environment is playing a role for sure. Maybe less than we originally thought. I think that it's easiest to get colonized in birth and in the first few months, and then it gets progressively harder. And so, for example, the stomach becomes much more acidic as kids get older, and so it's harder and harder to get new gut microbes as you get older. When you get really old, it gets less acidic again, and so people over 80, it's easier to get pathogens and maybe also good microbes. What we don't know is, you know, what does a jungle look like versus a desert, and we're starting to study some of that in the lab. And my prediction would be it should be quite different what ends up on your skin. There's one study from Finland by Ilkka Hanski, who was able to show that in houses that were pretty similar around a single city, that kids who had more native plants in their backyards had different microbe species on their skin and were at a much reduced risk of allergy. And so it does seem like these links exist. But the challenge is that we're dealing with thousands and thousands of species, so they're not going to be super simple.
Yeah. Joe, thank you so much. Brownie in Sun Prairie, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, Larry. This is a great discussion and a wonderful topic. Rob, my question, as a horticulturist and landscape person, I tend to work outside in the dirt and with plant material a good portion of the year. My question is actually two parts. One is working with that plant material, the pros and cons that may rub off from those plants, things that are shared with us, both pro and con, during contact with the various ecosystems, whether it be prairies or woodlots and so on. The more important and the part that I'm interested in is you'd mentioned living with dogs, and if you had a lifestyle that would allow you to get a dog, you would. My life has evolved where we have cats, numerous cats, and I know that they're great little carriers of bacteria and so on, both pro and con. And so I'm wondering if you could just talk about that a little bit. I can take this off the air unless you've got follow-on questions.
All right.
That's great. So the cat question, as you might guess, once we did our dog study, everybody wanted to know about cats. and I have a cat, so also interested. So we are starting. So we now have we initially had 40 houses we looked at. We've now looked at 1,000, and so we're starting to see an effect of cats. We understand way less about the extent to which that's beneficial. My prediction would be to the extent that what the benefit of the dog is that they're bringing in microbes either in their guts or from their feet that help us out, especially in urban environments, is that an outside cat might do some of the same. No one seems to have shown that yet, but nobody's looked very hard. So I do expect some effect of cats. On the other hand, I mean, cats are also the ones bringing in Toxoplasma gondii that messes with our brains, and they can also bring in Bartonella, which is a pathogen we're just starting to understand. And I mean, I think this is one of the medical challenges in light of and public health challenges is that, you know, we've spent several hundred years getting really, really good at killing bad things. We have not spent much time figuring out how to garden good things. And so, you know, per your profession, we know how to do it in our backyard, but we don't know how to do it in our houses. And so I think, I mean, personally, this is one of the things I'm really dedicated to is figuring out, moving forward, how do we garden a healthy assemblage of species on our skin, in our guts, in our homes, in our backyards, in our cities. And I think that's it's a major challenge, but boy, if we could rise to something in the next generation, that would be a pretty good one.
Hmm.
But getting back to the first part of your question, as far as I know, I mean, most of the effects that I can think of in terms of handling plants, in terms of their microbes, would be beneficial or have no effect.
That is very good news to hear. You know what? We're going to continue this conversation. We are at a point where we need to take a look at the news and weather and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, Rob. So, Rob Don, our biologist and author of The Wildlife of Our Bodies, our guest, and he'll be with us right up until 12:30 today here on the Ideas Network. Stay with us. News is next. It can be hard to get a handle on huge numbers, thinking about the number of stars in the skies or drops of water in the ocean, and can be sort of mind-boggling. But the truth is there is an equally overwhelming number of creatures living in and on in every person's body. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Rob Dunn, biologist and writer in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University, our guest today. His writing has appeared all over the place, Natural History, BBC Wildlife, National Geographic, among others. His first book was Every Living Thing, won the National Outdoor Book Award for Natural History Writing. And his latest book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies, takes a look at that long human relationship with other species, be they tapeworms or tigers, and how changes in those relationships affect our health and well-being. And Rob, once again, great to have you with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Larry. Thank you.
It's and we're getting lots of great questions, I think, from our audience as well. And I want to invite you to join in as you listen today. Give us a call with your questions and comments. Are you fascinated by what lives on or in your body, or would you like to know more about it, or maybe rather not think about it? Or maybe you have a question about a part of the body that might be what might be lurking in that part. Rob can take a shot at giving an answer. So 1-800-642-1234, the number to call. And I think you pretty well had covered the question that just before our news break. So I'm going to go to Steve in Viroqua next. Steve, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks. It's a great program, and this is a wonderful topic. It's of great interest to me, too. Your guest touched on cats before the break. I've read research on toxoplasmosis and how it can parasitize the human brain to change human behavior to the benefit of cats. And I would appreciate your guest perhaps being able to comment on that further, if he's aware of that research. My answer off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, so I spoke a little bit to the toxoplasma, gondii toxoplasmosis story earlier, but one of the interesting features of this parasite is that it gets into brains and manipulates them in such a way to its own benefit. And so we know that in mice and rats, it's doing that to help itself get into cats where it reproduces. It's actually possible to imagine that historically that if it was doing the same thing in humans, it would have predisposed us to being eaten by big cats. And we know that for other primates, that predation by big cats is actually really common. Leopards are a leading cause of death in chimpanzees. Even small gorillas get taken by leopards. And there are lots of extinct big cats that were maybe even more dangerous. And so it's possible that historically, you know, living in a cave, if you got toxoplasma gondii in your brain, that it would make you more likely to be chomped on by a leopard or a lion. We just don't know. But these kinds of stories are emblematic of the extent to which everything about our biology is shaped not just by interactions with the species that we encounter, but also those that we fail to encounter or those that our ancestors encountered. And so one example of this is if I screamed right now, it would trigger the fight-or-flight response in listeners' brains, but it would also make the hair stand up on your arm, which is a response to danger, to threat, to predators, that when we used to be covered with fur would make us look big and scary, and now that we've mostly lost our fur, makes us look stupid. So we have all of these things going on in our bodies that relate both to what we're exposed to, like toxoplasmosis, but also what we're not. And we're part of this big story. We're just starting to work out.
Yeah. Part of this fight or flight business, I was thinking back to my cat, Tiger. You can walk into a room and Tiger can be sound asleep, but as you walk across the room, his ears will kind of cock and turn with your movement. And he's sleeping, or he seems to be at least.
Yeah, well, and I mean, our own brains were shaped by that same kind of fight or flight alertness. And I think there's a fair argument to be made that that response is very maladaptive in our modern consequences, modern context. It gives us fear. It gives us anxiety. It's associated with our chronic stress. I mean, the same wiring we used to use to be ready for the tiger is the wiring that we now use to worry about taxes. It's actually, I think, a real problem in our modern situation, and it's not obvious how you deal with it, but I think it's interesting to acknowledge that that's part of what's going on, that our ears perk up in response to paperwork and unfinished duties in the way that the cats perk up in response to danger or food.
Yeah. Dan on Facebook wondered about what, if you wanted to see some of these external critters, what power microscope would he need?
So a microscope that would allow you to look at a paramecium, and so the kind that what some classrooms would have, would also allow you to look at these face mites. They're about the same size, and so you can do a scraping of your forehead with like a slide and just a slide cover and look at it under a standard classroom.
Yeah,
dissecting scope, but you'd be able to see it was present, and you would need higher resolution to see it in great detail. One of the interesting things we figured out recently is that they're really hard to study visually because they're so small. But we've teamed up with some folks who use scanning electron microscopy, which gives us these really high resolution images, and we've assumed for generations that they're in your hair follicles chewing away at cells. But with these new images, we've actually been able to show that they don't appear to have chewing mouth parts. They just have what looks like a big vacuum cleaner. And so, there's a lot to be discovered with these sorts of species, really, just by looking.
Wow. He wondered if there are mites and biotics in most cheeses.
So there are mites in some cheeses, and there are bacteria in every cheese.
Yeah.
And so there's a very fascinating field of food microbiology that's all about these amazing beneficial microscopic species that produce many of the foods we know and love.
We have Joe and Prairie du Chien up next with a question. Hi, Joe. Thank you for calling.
Hi. It sounds like the bacteria are a very basic part of our biosphere. I'm curious, how is it affecting our thinking on how we use herbicides and pesticides?
Or should it?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess my personal perspective would be that in general, we've benefited hugely from all of our biocides in terms of our health and well-being. But what we now need to figure out how to do is to be more discriminate in how we use them. And so I think a lot of the time we're using pesticides and herbicides for purely aesthetic reasons, to make the lawn look beautiful so we can show our neighbors that we're wealthy enough to make a big green showy thing as though we were all urban peacocks. And, you know, it seems plausible that there are many additional residual effects of these compounds, many more than we know about now. And so the idea that they might affect our microbes in negative ways seems very possible.
Hmm.
And so it depends how much you value being a showy peacock, I think.
Okay. Thanks, Joe. Annika in Madison, hi to you.
Hi there. I'm a nurse at a hospital, and I work in an inpatient unit. And we use special soap with our patients because we've been told that after 72 hours, their skin bacteria changes. I was wondering if the same thing happens to me because I work there.
Yeah, that's a great question. So it's been very, very difficult for researchers to study nurses and doctors because hospitals don't want other people to know what lives in their hospitals and on their employees. So it seems very likely that you have different microbes than the average person walking around, both as a function of how you're cleaning your hands and as a function of what you're exposed to in the hospitals. But we don't know that yet. What we do know is about individual species, so particular bad species. But in terms of good species, we just don't know. And so we're talking about a study right now on vets. And the vet clinics seem a little bit more amenable to having their folks studied. But so I would predict that, yes, you're very different, but no one's shown that yet.
Hmm.
I'm sure as a human, you're very different. But
would you recommend using an antibacterial soap at home then?
I don't. There's no evidence of additional health benefits of antibacterial soaps relative to ordinary soaps. In all the pairwise studies, they do about the same, and there's some evidence that the antibacterial soaps increase the recovery time from long-term illness. And there's a study that just came out yesterday showing that people who use antibacterial soaps are more likely to have Staphylococcus aureus on their skin, which is a potentially very problematic microbe.
Hmm.
And there are quite a few bacteria that seem to be able to actually metabolize the compound in antimicrobial soaps. And so the soap containers themselves have quite a few nasty bacteria on them.
Wow. There we go, Annika. Jennifer in Minnesota, hello.
Hi, how are you? I just had a question. I have two boys with autism, and so I've seen a lot of studies about autism and alternative medicines. And the only positive thing I've seen with alternative medicines and autism is probiotics. And I'm wondering if he has any information about that.
Yeah, so there's a growing literature about autism, the immune system, and microbes and worms. And it's growing so fast that I'm not very comfortable providing a state of the research summary. But it does seem as though, you know, there are these beneficial effects of some microbes in reducing the activity of the overreactivity of the immune system, and some of the worms do the same thing. The worms are trying to trick us, and so they have these great compounds that reduce our immune activity. And so the use of probiotics falls in that line. The argument is you're getting good microbes that help to get your immune system back in a less reactive state. And certainly there's no harm to them. The challenge is exactly what's going on there, particularly with autism, is still very, very poorly understood. And it's not very simple to get the probiotics past the stomach and then to get them to establish. And so one of the questions is, you know, what are the best probiotics that will really establish, in your sons? And that seems still relatively unclear. And so it doesn't seem like there's any harm there, and there's some potential benefit. And I would keep a close eye on that literature because I think it's emerging very quickly. And so to keep reading the Science Daily updates, because I think there's a lot of hope in the next few years for what we might know there and what might be possible that's not now.
Mm. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Yeah, appreciate your call very much. We had, you know, talking about various problems, medical problems, I think one of the fascinating stories in your book is The Wildlife of Our Bodies is that the desperate search for a cure for people with Crohn's disease that's been undertaken. Maybe we can talk about Crohn's, and then a scientist who developed an innovative approach to Crohn's inspired by pronghorns, of all things.
Yes, so Crohn's is one of these many autoimmune diseases that's become much, much more common and mostly in countries with really good public health. And over the last 50 or 60 years, and so the U.S. in particular has a rising incidence of Crohn's, ulcerative colitis, asthma, and then allergies are a little bit of a different story but related. And one of the things that these problems all share is that the immune system is overreactive, that it's reacting too strongly either to the body or some outside antigen. And one of the interesting features of that overreactivity is that seems in and of itself very novel. And so people have started to look at what's changed in our interactions with other species recently. And one of the things that certainly has changed is the prevalence of worms in people's guts. And so 100 years ago, all around the world, most people would have been exposed to a worm. And there are tons of kinds of worms that we get exposed to, hookworms and pinworms and whipworms. And if you study worms, they're these beautiful, magical things. And if you've got one, not always. And so it began to be argued that maybe reintroducing these worms would quell some of this immune reactivity. And people talk about this in different ways, but essentially one of the ideas is that, to go back to the pronghorn, so the pronghorn run faster than they need to, and they run faster than they need to in part because they evolved to run with much larger, faster predators around, like the American cheetah, that when humans arrived in the Americas, they extinguished. And so now the pronghorn just runs too fast and wastes energy. And so the idea in the context of our gut is that our gut, too, is running too fast. It's running to keep up with the worms that are no longer there. And so maybe if we introduce worms that are relatively innocuous, they would help to keep that running in check.
Mm.
And so there have now been a number of clinical trials, and even since the book, that show a lot of promise in using these worms therapeutically to treat Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. And people differ in terms of whether they're thinking about those worms as mutualists, really as a beneficial species, or kind of more like a domesticate, a species we know has some positive effect that if we use it effectively can be a good medicine. And so there are now some labs in Mexico where you can go to get worms, and quite a number of people who've done that swear by it. But it's also not universally effective. And so it's interesting frontier where, if you're a scientist who just finds these things interesting, it's fascinating and this amazing moment. If you're somebody who has Crohn's disease, it's a really awful, debilitating disease that's become very, very common. And so you want some cure now. And so worms are one of the things that are there. There's also a lot going on now with fecal transplants and Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. That's further in the future, I think. I think I've babbled on a little bit there, Larry. But
No, that was really fascinating. We had Jenny on Facebook wondered if it's better to take fewer showers or is overbathing bad?
We don't know, Jenny. In our belly button study, we had one participant who never bathed. Like the benefit of our study is we let people sample themselves, so we didn't have to go that close. but he actually had a couple of lineages of another kind of microbe called Narcan. They are these very, very slow-growing microbes that we think of as living in deep-sea vents. And what's interesting is that
it's possible that historically that those were a kind of microbe that most of us had in our skin, and in the last 100 years, frequent bathing has rid us of them. You know, and if you look at the old kings and their bathing behavior, they'd have their ceremonial annual bath, and that was about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems like bathing has probably changed our skin microbes a lot. I don't have a good sense yet of whether that's been good or bad on the whole. And so I don't have a great recommendation.
One way or the other. Okay.
Yeah.
Connie in Portage, hi.
Good morning. I have a question. I'm a nurse, but I went to school in the 80s. So what we learned was Staphylococcus aureus was the natural, the good staph on our skin. And you said it's dangerous, and I'm confused unless things have changed.
So there are a bunch of different lineages of staph. And there are more lineages than we have. There are more kinds of staph than we have names. And so there are good staph aureus and there are bad staph aureus. And there are also, the most common good microbe we have on our skin is a closely related staphylococcus. And so this is someplace where the language we use to describe these things has failed our accumulated understanding. And so you want the good staph on your body. You don't want these bad lineages. And so what this recent study has in fact shown is that one of these lineages that we know is bad becomes more common with the antimicrobial wipes. And the methicillin-resistant staph, the one we worry about, MRSA, that's also closely related to those lineages, but it's one that's gone bad. So what you learned was right, but we now know that there are a whole bunch of these very closely related staph. And it's the interesting thing there is that when people test for staph in an infection, they often don't discern to a great extent which one of these is present.
Oh, man. Thank you, Connie, very much for calling. And, Rob, this has been a fascinating 90 minutes. I really appreciate you taking the time. You had a pretty broad range of questions, and you answered them all very eloquently. And I hope we have a chance to do this again.
Yeah, this was wonderful. And if I've not answered anything well, or people have follow-up, you can find us at yourwildlife.org, where you'll see all our projects. And I've had just a great time. What a wonderful audience.
Yourwildlife.org is the – and I think we have that up on my Facebook page. If not, we'll put it up there, so a link. Thank you very much, Rob. I really appreciate it. And I certainly hope we can talk again.
Yes. Thank you, Larry, and all the species on you.
Okay. Rob Dunn, biologist and writer in the Department of Biology at North Carolina State University. I'm thinking you should come to the University of Wisconsin, is what I think, and be a faculty member here. We'd love to have him. And, you know, we just barely touched on his book. I mean, there is so much. He has so, you know, he knows more people who have been bitten by poisonous snakes than anybody I know, among other things. We can. You'll learn when you read his book, The Wildlife of Our Bodies. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. We've got lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're a great audience, and thanks again for listening.